Everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and nope, do not double-check your calendars. This is not the end of the year, and that is the iconic Unsolved Mysteries update music you just heard. It is now time for The Trail Went Cold's fifth special update episode. So as I'm sure you're well aware, we already dropped our last update episode just over 2 months ago at the end of 2023, so you might be wondering why we're already releasing another one. Well, believe it or not, since the start of the new year, there have been major developments and resolutions in quite a few cases which were featured on The Trail Went Cold, so 2024 is certainly shaping up to be something special. I'm actually on vacation this week, and we just dropped our two-part 8-year anniversary episode, so during my absence, I thought it would be a good idea to start off year 9 of this podcast by putting together a new update episode in order to share all these new developments. Some of these updates are pretty amazing, including the resolution of a cold case that was nearly 80 years old. But before we begin, I should mention that this episode will exclusively focus on updates which have taken place since the end of 2023, so if you want to learn about Trail Went Cold cases which were solved prior to that, I'd recommend going back and listening to our previous updates on episodes number 155, 257, 310, and 359. Anyway, without any further ado, let us now begin The Trail Went Cold's fifth official update episode. So ironically enough, the news about our first update came out on the very same day I dropped our last update episode on December the 27th, 2023. It involves the 1970 disappearance of 25-year-old Donna Lass, which I covered over 7 years ago on Minisode number 4. Donna was employed as a registered nurse at the first aid station of the Sahara Tahoe Hotel and Casino in Stateline, Nevada, and showed up to work her scheduled shift, which ran from 6 p.m. on September the 5th until 2 a.m. on September the 6th. Appropriately enough, Stateline was located right next to the California-Nevada state line, and Donna resided at an apartment complex in South Lake Tahoe, California, which was only about a quarter mile from the casino. However, sometime near the end of her shift, Donna inexplicably vanished. She treated her last patient at the first aid station at 1:40 a.m. and wrote an entry in her logbook at 1:50. Since the entry appeared to be unfinished, and no witnesses recalled seeing Donna leave work at the end of her shift, there was speculation that she may have been abducted while she was in the midst of writing this entry. Later that same day, Donna's boss and her landlord both received phone calls from an unidentified man who told them that Donna was going out of town to deal with a family emergency, but this turned out not to be true, and Donna was never heard from again. Donna's car was found parked outside her apartment complex, but all of her personal belongings were left behind, aside from her purse and the clothing she had been wearing that night. Donna had only recently moved into the apartment, but since it was located so close to the casino, it's theorized that she may have walked to work for her final shift and never drove her car that night at all. For 6 months, investigators were left completely perplexed by Donna's disappearance, but on March the 22nd, 1971, Paul Avery, a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, received a bizarre postcard with a collage pasted on the back. It featured an advertisement for Forest Pines Condominiums in Lake Tahoe, which had an artist's rendering of a small village of condos near a snow-covered wooded area. Some phrases which had been cut out of newspapers and magazines were pasted across the ad, and these included Sierra Club, Around in the Snow, Peek Through the Pines, Past Lake Tahoe Areas, and Sought Victim Number 12. A hole was also punched over some pine trees located in the upper right-hand corner of the ad, but most importantly, the postcard featured a circle cross symbol on it, which resembled the crosshairs of a gun sight. And of course, this symbol was associated with the Zodiac Killer, one of the most infamous unidentified serial killers of all time. Officially, the Zodiac has been linked to four crimes which took place in California from December of 1968 until October of 1969, which left a total of five people murdered and two others seriously wounded. However, he would frequently mail taunting letters to the press, in which he claimed to have been responsible for murdering a few dozen victims, but since he's never been identified, no one can be certain how many people he actually killed. Paul Avery was one of the primary reporters on the Zodiac case, and by the time he received this cryptic postcard, Zodiac had already taken credit for killing at least 17 people. While Donna Lass's name was never specifically used, the mention of Lake Tahoe and the phrase "sought victim 12" seemed to imply that Donna may have been the Zodiac's 12th victim. Of course, this didn't seem to fit the MO for Zodiac's other known crimes, since Donna was a missing person, and Zodiac was not known for hiding his victims' bodies. And would Zodiac have gone to the trouble of calling Donna's boss and landlord and feeding them a false story about a family emergency? Well, it's possible that Zodiac was taking credit for a crime he did not commit. The postcard may not have even been sent by Zodiac himself, but by a copycat instead. If someone else was responsible for Donna's disappearance, perhaps this was their attempt to mislead the investigation and send it in the wrong direction. Well, debate would rage over this topic for the next five decades, but near the end of 2023, it was announced that Donna Lass's skull had been found and positively identified as belonging to her. It turned out that her skull was originally discovered on August the 5th, 1986, in a drainage ditch in Placer County, California, over 70 miles away from South Lake Tahoe. This spot was located in the Sierra Nevada mountain range by Interstate 80 and State Route 20, near the unincorporated community of Emigrant Gap. When the Placer County Sheriff's Office found the skull, they kept it stored away for the next 37 years, until they decided to team up with the Placer County District Attorney's Office in order to form a cold case unit. One of their first acts was to send the skull to the California Justice Department Bureau of Forensic Sciences, who created a DNA profile for it. It eventually wound up being matched to a DNA sample which one of Donna's sisters had submitted to the South Lake Tahoe Police Department, who had kept it on file for the past few years. Once the match was made, Donna's surviving family members were notified that the skull belonged to her, confirming she was deceased. So, needless to say, when I heard this news, it took me by complete surprise, as I had no idea that this case was being actively investigated, and I'm thinking that when the DNA testing was run on the skull, no one had any idea that it might be linked to a potential Zodiac victim. Since no other remains or evidence were found in the area when Donna's skull was discovered, investigators have been unable to determine her exact cause of death or officially rule that she was the victim of a homicide, though I'd say it's very likely she was. But the authorities have confirmed that they have yet to find any conclusive evidence that the Zodiac Killer was responsible for Donna's death, though sleuths have been carefully studying the cryptic "Peek Through the Pines" postcard to see if it provides any potential hints about the location where Donna's skull was found. I know that when I released my original Trail Went Cold minisode, I was inclined to believe that Zoda was not a Zodiac victim, as I suspected that he simply read about Donna's disappearance in the newspapers and decided to take credit for it, meaning that the real perpetrator may have gotten incredibly lucky that a notorious serial killer decided to insert themselves into their case. The issue is that, as far as I can tell, no one has ever been pushed forward as a solid suspect in Donna's case who would have had a motive to harm her. But I do find it interesting that she vanished right after moving into a new apartment, and whoever made the phone calls with the phony family emergency cover story obviously seemed to have enough knowledge about Donna's personal life to know who her boss and her new landlord were. I'm not so sure if the perpetrator would have been brazen enough to abduct Donna directly from the casino, as the detail about the unfinished entry in the logbook may be nothing more than red herring. Donna may have finished her shift and was in the midst of walking home, or had already arrived home, when she was abducted, and the responsible party disposed of her remains in Placer County, 70 miles away. But while there's no hard evidence that Donna was a victim of the Zodiac Killer, there's no evidence that she wasn't either, so I guess you can't rule out that possibility. Even if no one is conclusively linked to Donna's death, at least her surviving relatives have some answers about what happened to her, and here's hoping that a new investigation might eventually lead to a resolution. So the next update we're going to discuss involves one of the most memorable cases ever featured on Unsolved Mysteries, which I also covered on episode number 73 of The Trail Went Cold, the murder of Dexter Stefanik. Dexter was a 67-year-old widower who left his son's farm in Corbett, Oregon on November the 18th, 1985, in order to make a 2,000-mile drive back to his home in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. But the following morning, Dexter's burning car was discovered in the parking lot of the Bad Route Rest Area, located alongside Interstate 94 in Dawson County, Montana, which was just past the halfway point of Dexter's road trip. It was clear that arson had taken place, and someone had used gasoline to set fire to the car, but Dexter himself was nowhere to be found. Two eyewitnesses had reported seeing a white Chevy 4x4 pickup truck in the parking lot earlier that morning, and one of them even claimed that he saw an unidentified male wearing a parka driving Dexter's car into the rest area, and he was carrying two plastic containers which likely contained gasoline. Since the pickup truck was gone by the time Dexter's burning car was discovered, this man had probably started the fire before fleeing the scene. Dexter would remain a missing person for 3.5 months, but on March the 8th, 1986, his body was discovered beneath a discarded mattress at a remote landfill located about 17 miles from the rest area, and it turned out he had been beaten before he was shot twice in the head. Dexter's wallet and suitcase were also found at the landfill, and since they both still had money, robbery did not appear to be the motive for the murder. The crime left everyone completely puzzled, because while it seemed likely that Dexter had pulled over at the rest area and crossed paths with his killer, what would compel someone to shoot this harmless elderly man? One of the witnesses who saw the pickup truck said that it appeared to have Arizona license plates, suggesting that the killer was not from the area and was just passing through. But on the other hand, the landfill where Dexter's body was found was a private dump site, which was not particularly easy to find, so could the perpetrator have been a local who was familiar with the area? Since the crime seemed completely random, I did not have high hopes that it would ever be solved until a surprising announcement was made shortly after the start of the new year. On January the 19th, the Glendive Ranger Review newspaper published an article which reported that Dawson County Sheriff Ross Kanan and the Dawson County Attorney had identified Dexter Stefanik's killer as 79-year-old Charles Gary Sullivan. Sullivan has an extensive criminal history and is currently serving a 15-year prison sentence for the 1979 murder of 21-year-old Julia Woodward. On February the 1st of that year, Woodward boarded a flight from San Francisco to Reno, Nevada, but disappeared sometime after she landed. Nearly 2 months later, on March the 25th, Woodward's body was discovered in a shallow grave in Hungry Valley, about 15 miles north of Reno. Her hands were bound with zip ties, she had adhesive bandages over her eyes, she was gagged with a scarf, and someone had murdered her by bludgeoning her to death with a rock. The case remained unsolved until November of 2019, when DNA evidence taken from Woodward's pants was matched to Sullivan. 12 years earlier, Sullivan had been arrested for abducting and attempting to sexually assault a young female hitchhiker in California, so he was forced to register as a sex offender and submit a sample of his DNA, so it was already in the system when it was matched to the DNA evidence from the Woodward murder. At the time of his arrest, Sullivan was residing in Yavapai County, Arizona, before he was extradited to Washoe County, Nevada to face the murder charge. Sullivan initially entered a plea of not guilty and was scheduled to go on trial last year, but in June of 2023, a plea deal was arranged in which Sullivan would enter a plea of no contest to second-degree murder in exchange for a 15-year sentence. This sentence included eligibility for parole after 5 years, But since Sullivan has been given credit for time served since his arrest in 2019, he will technically be up for parole this coming November. While Sullivan has never been charged with any other murders, the authorities have expressed their belief that he might be a serial killer. He is considered to be a suspect in the unsolved murder of 17-year-old Jenny Smith, whose skeletal remains were found off a remote trail outside Reno in November of 1979, only about a half mile from the spot where Julia Woodward's body had been discovered earlier that same year. Like Woodward, Smith's cause of death was blunt force trauma, and she also had adhesive bandages over her eyes. According to Dawson County Sheriff Kanan, Sullivan was identified as a possible culprit in Dexter's case 2 years ago, but even though he has been publicly identified as the perpetrator, the sheriff's office says there is not enough evidence to charge or convict him. But here's an excerpt from the aforementioned Glendale Ranger Review article about why they believe Sullivan is the guy. Quote, Kanan noted that local authorities were directed towards Sullivan based on witness statements from the 1985 case, noting that his vehicle, license plate, traveling pattern, age, and physical description all matched the statement given to investigators, as well as his criminal history providing cause to believe he possibly murdered Stefanik. It's also been reported that when investigators attempted to interview Sullivan in prison about the case, he would not speak to them, and instead invoked his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent to avoid self-incrimination. But even though Sullivan will not be charged, the Stefanik family wrote a letter to the sheriff's office in which they stated that they were satisfied with the conclusion that he murdered Dexter and have concurred with the decision to officially close the investigation. Sheriff Kanan stated, quote, There are many questions that we would like to have asked Mr. Sullivan, but couldn't. However, closure for the family is important, and I'm glad we could provide that. End quote. Well, this case has always haunted me since I saw it featured on Unsolved Mysteries 35 years ago, so it's pretty surreal to think that it's finally been solved. But not surprisingly, there have been mixed reactions to law enforcement's decision to close the investigation, as it's very uncommon to publicly name a living suspect as being the killer without charging them. I mean, in the last several years, we've seen numerous examples of deceased suspects being publicly named as a killer because genetic genealogy posthumously linked their DNA to a crime, but as far as I can tell, we don't have any DNA or conclusive evidence like that in this case. I've really been wanting to hear more details about why the Dawson County Sheriff's Office is so certain that Sullivan committed this crime, but I've only seen one article get published about this news and no further information has been released. I mean, I am hoping that law enforcement has done their due diligence with investigating Sullivan. We do know that he hailed from Arizona, and the white Chevy 4x4 pickup truck seen in the Bad Route rest area had Arizona plates. If Sullivan was driving a truck with that description back then, and can be placed in Montana in November of 1985, then I think there's a pretty good chance he's the right guy. But Sullivan's known crimes involve abducting, sexually assaulting, and murdering young women, so what could have driven him to kill a 67-year-old man? Since Sullivan is already a convicted murderer serving time in prison, he's definitely not an innocent man who is having his reputation slandered by being linked to another unsolved crime, so I can see why investigators would have felt comfortable naming him as Dexter's killer. If Sullivan serves his full 15-year sentence for the murder of Julia Woodward, he will be in his 90s before he's released, but he is technically eligible for parole this coming November. Even though Sullivan's DNA was found on Woodward's pants, his defense attorney tried to argue that this only proved he knew the victim, not that he killed her, so this might be why the state agreed to let him enter a plea of no contest. I'm not sure what the odds were of Sullivan receiving parole this year, but now that he's been publicly named as being responsible for another murder, I doubt the odds of him getting out are that high, so this may have been a strategic attempt by law enforcement to ensure that Sullivan never walks out of prison. This could be why he invoked his Fifth Amendment rights when investigators attempted to question him about Dexter's case, as he probably doesn't want to jeopardize his potential chances of being released. While I'm not satisfied by how this situation turned out, if the Stefanik family are satisfied with this conclusion and have given their blessing to close the case, then I suppose that's all we can really ask for. But if any additional information comes out about how Sullivan was linked to this crime, I'll be sure to share it on a future update episode. So the next update I'm going to discuss is a case from our podcast Home Country of Canada, and that's the murder of 36-year-old Byron Carr, which I covered nearly 2 years ago on episode number 281. The crime took place in Charlottetown, the capital city of Canada's smallest province, Prince Edward Island, and this was considered to be PEI's only known unsolved homicide in modern times. After not being heard from for over 24 hours, Byron Carr's body was discovered inside the bedroom of his residence on the morning of November the 12th, 1988. He had been dead for approximately 26 to 30 hours and was strangled to death with a towel. Byron was also stabbed in the abdomen with a kitchen knife, and the words, "I will kill again," have been scrawled on his bedroom wall in ballpoint pen. The evidence seemed to indicate Byron had consensual sex with another man before he was murdered, as a piece of underwear which contained unidentified male DNA and likely belonged to the killer was left behind at the scene. Byron was essentially outed by his death, as only a select few people knew that he was interested in men and spent a lot of time hanging around with Charlottetown's LGBTQ community. Since Byron had worked as a high school English teacher, you can understand why he remained in the closet for fear that this sort of thing could destroy his career. There was also fear that Byron's murder was a hate crime and that more members of the LGBTQ community would be targeted. And unfortunately, the community was not very trusting of local law enforcement back in 1988, which may have hampered the investigation. In fact, it's been rumored that homophobia may have played a role in this case remaining unsolved for decades, but the investigation would be jump-started in 2007 by Detective Sergeant Brad McConnell, who is currently the Charlottetown Police Chief. An interesting development occurred in 2013 when investigators announced that they had identified an accomplice in Byron's murder. While this man was not directly involved in the crime, he apparently returned to Byron's residence alongside the killer in order to help him retrieve a key piece of evidence. Over the years, the accomplice allegedly made incriminating statements to multiple eyewitnesses in which he shared details about the crime which were not public knowledge, but since this man had passed away by 2013, investigators declined to name him publicly. So this was a very unique situation in which the police knew the identity of someone who helped the killer cover up the crime, but not the identity of the killer himself. The DNA evidence from the crime could not be matched to DNA in the known criminal databases, and at one point, investigators stated that since this DNA had deteriorated over the years, they were uncertain if they would be able to perform any advanced forensic techniques, such as genetic genealogy. Well, thankfully, it turned out they could. Just over 1 month ago, on January the 26th, Chief Brad McConnell held a press conference to announce that a 50-year-old suspect named Todd Joseph Gallant had been arrested and charged with one count of first-degree murder and one count of interfering with human remains in relation to Byron Carr's death. Back in 1988, Gallant was 21 years old and was believed to be residing in Charlottetown and had been convicted on a breaking and entering charge the previous year. Gallant is believed to have relocated to the United States shortly after Byron's murder and lived in such states as Texas and Arkansas, where he also apparently has a criminal record. At some point, Gallant was living under the name Todd Joseph Irving, and after returning to PEI in 2022, he was living in the town of Surrey at the time of his arrest. Sure enough, it turned out that forensic genealogy had been used to match the DNA evidence to Gallant, thanks to assistance from such organizations as Wyndham Forensic Group and Convergence Investigative Genetic Genealogy. After a DNA profile was created for the killer, it was uploaded to some family genealogy sites and matched to one of Gallant's relatives, which eventually paved the way for his identification. It was also announced that around the same time as Gallant's arrest, a second person was arrested in relation to the case and later released, but the investigation into this individual is going to continue in order to determine if they had any involvement in the crime. I have no idea who the second person could be, but obviously, it's not the accomplice who was mentioned in 2013, since that individual is already deceased. Of course, even though Byron's murderer wrote, "I will kill again," on his bedroom wall, there's nothing to indicate that Gallant did kill again, since he is yet to be linked to any additional murders. However, his name apparently never came up as a potential suspect during the investigation until the DNA match, so investigators are attempting to build a timeline for Gallant to track his movements over the past 35 years. When asked at the press conference whether he thought Byron's murder was a hate crime, Chief McConnell replied, quote, "That particular answer is one we all want to know. The sensational note left on the crime scene would suggest it was. Was it hate involved? Were there other factors? I know that we've always, and the family has always, just wanted the truth, no matter what it was. And hopefully we can get that." End quote. Even though Byron's parents have both since passed away, all but one of his siblings are still alive, and his brother, John Carr, described the arrest of Byron's killer as, quote-unquote, "like a weight being lifted off you." A defense attorney representing Gallant appeared on his behalf in court to state that his client was seeking legal aid and waiting for disclosure from the prosecution, so they were not ready to proceed at this time. A judge adjourned the case until March the 7th, which, appropriately enough, is the date of this episode's release, so perhaps by the time you listen to this, there will be more news about the status of the case. At this point, we do not know how Gallant is going to plead to the crime, and when and if he'll go on trial, but I will definitely keep you apprised of any further developments on future episodes. So now we're moving on to what is undoubtedly one of the biggest updates our podcast has ever experienced. I still remember how on the exact date of our podcast's 7-year anniversary last year, it was announced that the 1930 disappearance of 2-year-old Mary Agnes Moroney had been solved, which made it the oldest cold case featured on The Trail Went Cold to reach a resolution. Well, history pretty much repeated itself this year, because just a few days before our podcast's 8-year anniversary, it was announced that a missing persons case from 1945 had been solved. The disappearance of Mary Jane Van Gilder. You probably heard me talk about this one on our last update episode from a few months ago, but as a refresher, we originally featured the case on episode number 194 after I was contacted by one of Mary Jane's granddaughters, Mindy Wilson, who asked if I would cover it. Even though Mindy was not born until after her grandmother went missing and never got the chance to meet her, she was still hoping to learn the truth about what happened to her. And remarkably, she was able to put me in touch with Detective Adam Turner of the Shelby, Ohio Police Department, who had started investigating this case in 2018 after a missing persons report was officially filed for the first time, and he was not deterred about taking on an unsolved disappearance that was over 70 years old. Mary Jane Van Gilder was a 33-year-old married mother of 5 children who lived in Marion County, West Virginia. But since her husband, James Van Gilder, was alleged to be abusive, the couple wound up separating in 1943. Sometime afterward, Mary Jane decided to move away and relocate to Ohio and got a job at the Shelby Army Air Force Depot. She remained in the area for about a year, but in March of 1945, Mary Jane quit her job at the depot and just seemed to drop out of sight. Even though she had maintained contact with her children while living in Ohio, all of her communication ceased after that, so her family had no idea what happened to her. 1 month before her disappearance, Mary Jane had filed a petition for divorce from James, accusing him of, quote-unquote, extreme cruelty and gross neglect of duty. James officially filed for divorce in November of 1945, and since neither Mary Jane nor her legal counsel responded to the petition, the divorce was granted, and James received full custody of their 5 children. Now, if you heard my last update episode, one of the leads that Detective Turner investigated was the discovery of some skeletal remains for an unidentified Jane Doe in Preble County, Ohio, on May the 25th, 1968, as he wanted to explore the possibility that the victim could have been Mary Jane. But once the remains were exhumed and DNA testing was performed, it turned out that not only was the victim not Mary Jane, but this Jane Doe was actually a John Doe. On November the 17th, 2023, Turner held a press conference to announce that the decedent had been positively identified as Albert Allen Frost, who had not been seen by his family since 1963 or 1964. Albert's story is quite intriguing on its own, but since I don't want to repeat myself too much, I'd encourage you to listen to our last update episode if you want to learn more details. But even though this lead did not provide a resolution in Mary Jane's case, the silver lining is that it wound up providing answers to another family, as prior to this, Albert Frost had been completely lost to history. However, Mary Jane's relatives would not have to wait too much longer for their own answers, because on February the 12th, 2024, Detective Turner held another press conference in which he announced that Mary Jane Van Gilter's disappearance had also been solved. So the key piece of information which paved the way for a resolution was uncovered by a quote-unquote civilian sleuth, but even though Adam wanted to give credit to this person at the press conference, they preferred to remain anonymous. While working at the Shelby Army Air Force Depot, Mary Jane was transferred from the labor and equipment pool to the position of high lift and fork operator in February of 1945, though she decided to quit only a few weeks later, and the official reason listed in her military personnel file was, quote-unquote, added household duties. A few years ago, Turner managed to obtain the file and published it online in hopes that perhaps someone might notice an important detail that would be crucial to the investigation. Well, that turned out to be exactly what happened, because even though there were dozens of names listed in the file, the anonymous sleuth pointed Turner towards the name Percy L. Sebrin, who had been the previous high lift and fork operator before Mary Jane got the position, and he presumably helped train her. While Turner found a profile page for Percy Lee Sebrin at the website findagrave.com, which showed that he died in Kansas City, Missouri on April the 14th, 1969, at the age of 49, and it turned out he had been run over by a train. But most importantly, this led to a separate Find a Grave page for Percy's wife, and her tombstone bore the name Mary J. Sebrin and had the birth date November the 19th, 1911, which just happened to be Mary Jane Van Gilder's birth date. It also revealed that she died in Arkansas on May the 31st, 1990, at the age of 79. The couple's headstones were located in New Forest Cemetery in the village of Forest, Louisiana, which happened to be Percy's home state. And even more interestingly, there was a Find a Grave profile page for Percy and Mary's first child, Percy Sebrin Jr., who had been born in Louisiana on December the 9th, 1945. As you recall, the reason listed for Mary Jane Van Gilder quitting her job was, quote-unquote, added household duties, and, well, since Percy Jr. was born 9 months later, you do the math. Percy Jr. passed away in August of 2004, and the Sebrins had another son named Kenneth, who died in January of 2022. However, it turned out that Percy Jr. had four children, and Detective Turner managed to reach out to one of his daughters, Bobby, on Facebook. Bobby revealed that after their two sons were born, her grandparents spent most of their lives living in Arkansas, and she described Mary Jane as being an amazing grandmother. However, she was also very secretive about her life, and it was apparently one of those subjects the family never discussed. Before Mary Jane died of cancer in 1990, she told one of her granddaughters that, quote-unquote, there was something she couldn't tell her, and that she could never find out. Well, I remember watching the live stream of Detective Turner's press conference and getting goosebumps when he displayed some photographs that Mary Jane Sebrin's children had provided of her from the late 1970s and early 80s. He did a side-by-side comparison of a photo of Mary Jane Van Gilder from the 1940s and a photo of an elderly Mary Jane Sebrin while she was in her 70s, and it was obvious they were the same person. Turner also confirmed that Mary Jane Sebrin's grandchildren provided a document containing her signature, and it had distinct similarities to samples of Mary Jane Van Gilder's handwriting. And sure enough, it was finally revealed that one of Mary Jane Sebring's granddaughters had taken a DNA test, which showed that she had an ancestral relation to Mary Jane Van Gilder's surviving children and grandchildren, proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that Mary Jane Sebring was Mary Jane Van Gilder. So it appears that while living in Shelby, Mary Jane started a relationship with one of her co-workers, Percy L. Sebring, and became pregnant with his child, and at some point during 1945, they relocated to Louisiana. Since her official marriage records have yet to be found, we still don't know when exactly they got married, but Percy Jr. was born by the end of the year. Even though Mary Jane's social security number had been listed in her personnel file and was made public, she had somehow managed to obtain a different social security number when she started living as Mary Jane Sebring, and she would use this number for the rest of her life. Obviously, even though Mary Jane's grandchildren from her marriage to Percy had glowing things to say about her, this revelation came as a complete shock to them, and as you can imagine, it left Mary Jane's surviving children and grandchildren from her first marriage with mixed feelings. At the press conference, Mindy Wilson made a tearful speech in which she stated, quote, "This has been a long time coming and a long journey, but our family finally has closure. This journey of searching for our grandmother started many years ago, before I was even born. My aunt never gave up hope, and is so happy to know what happened to her." End quote. Mindy also said that she has visited her grandmother's grave in Louisiana and laid flowers upon it. Detective Turner also made this statement, quote, "What is unknown, and what will probably never be known, is why Mary Jane decided to leave her family behind in West Virginia and start a new life elsewhere. A family who loved her, cared for her, and missed her for 79 years. What it shows is that our decisions can reverberate through time and distance and affect generations of our immediate family and descendants, and that our choices in life need to be made in the consideration of how it will affect those who love us." End quote. Sadly, while some of Mary Jane's children from her first marriage are still alive, one of them, named Martha, passed away on January the 30th, 2 weeks before the press conference, but Adam was able to tell Martha what happened to her mother before the news went public. Turner also gave a lot of credit to his boss, Shelby Police Chief Lance Combs, who gave him a lot of latitude to investigate this old missing persons case, and Chief Combs said that Adam voluntarily funded his own out-of-state travels related to the investigation and performed them on his own time. And as a side note, during the press conference, Adam gave a shout-out to The Trail Went Cold, as well as the other podcasts and YouTube shows that covered Mary Jane's case. He did the same thing during the press conference about the identification of Albert Frost, but it was still pretty surreal and greatly appreciated. So yeah, I think it's safe to say that witnessing the resolution of this case is one of the most amazing things I've experienced since the launch of The Trail Went Cold. Since there was no direct evidence of foul play, my gut always told me that Mary Jane might have disappeared voluntarily and started a new life somewhere, but I wasn't sure that anyone would be able to prove it after all these years. However, this whole situation just shows how beneficial true crime media can be, because even though this case was over 7 decades old, Detective Turner felt that the best chance to solve it was to get every piece of information he had out there into the open and hope that it might bring about a new lead, which could break the case wide open. And wouldn't you know it, the turning point was when an amateur sleuth just happened to make note of the right name in Mary Jane's personnel file. I know I've done a number of cases on the podcast which are all still unsolved, because law enforcement was either corrupt or just did a poor investigation, but the polar opposite occurred here, because Adam Turner is just an exceptional police officer who truly cares about solving cold cases and does not believe they should be ignored just because they happened a long time ago. When he arranged for the Preble County Jane Doe to be exhumed, he held the mindset that even if this lead didn't pan out and the victim wasn't Mary Jane, this was still a worthwhile endeavor because some other decedent might wind up being identified, and sure enough, this finally led to some answers for the family of another long-forgotten victim named Albert Frost. So yes, this whole story just proves that no cold case is truly unsolvable, and you should never let this dissuade you from giving it attention. So we have one more update to talk about, though it's related to an individual with a loose connection to one of our featured cases rather than the case itself. 3 years ago, we released a two-part series about the 1987 murders of Don Henry and Kevin Ives, aka the Boys on the Tracks case, which took place in Saline County, Arkansas, and was covered on episodes 213 and 214 in order to commemorate our 5-year anniversary. Well, there's no new information to report about this case since it's still unsolved, but you might recall that I spent some time discussing a former pro wrestler named William Albert Haynes, who had competed under the name Billy Jack Haynes. In 2018, Billy Jack had come forward and confessed that he was involved in the Boys on the Tracks murders and shared the full story in a YouTube video. In 1987, Billy Jack was still a full-time employee of the World Wrestling Federation, now known as World Wrestling Entertainment, but he claimed that he had a side gig working as security for drug drops. He said he traveled to Saline County and was present when Don Henry and Kevin Ives stumbled upon their drug drop, so his associates proceeded to murder the two boys and place their bodies on the tracks in hopes that an oncoming train would mutilate their bodies and make their deaths look like an accident. He also said the drug drop had been organized by a quote-unquote criminal politician and heavily implied that it was Bill Clinton, who was governor of Arkansas at that time. Well, I'm sure most of you know that I'm a lifelong pro wrestling fan, and yes, I was watching the WWF when Billy Jack competed there, and even owned a wrestling doll for him at one point. When he came forward and made his confession, it was reported on by a number of mainstream media outlets in Arkansas, but anyone with knowledge of the wrestling business and Billy Jack Haynes' reputation just rolled their eyes, as he is notorious for spreading wild conspiracy theories which have no basis in reality, and it's likely that a long history of drug abuse, injuries, and CTE have done serious damage to his mental health. So yeah, I never believed for a second that he was involved in the Boys on the Tracks murders, but sadly, he has recently found himself in serious legal trouble for allegedly committing another murder. Just 1 month ago, on the morning of February the 8th, police responded to a report of a shooting at a residence in the Lentz neighborhood of Portland, Oregon. A 2-hour standoff took place involving an individual who was described as being uncooperative before he was finally taken into custody. While the person's name was not released publicly for the next few days, it was reported that he was a former pro wrestler and had been arrested on suspicion of murder, and it was eventually confirmed that it was none other than Billy Jack Haynes, who was currently 70 years old. And tragically, it came out that the victim of this murder was Billy Jack's 85-year-old wife, Jeanette McCraft, who was killed with a single gunshot wound. Following his arrest, Billy Jack was taken to a hospital to get treatment for an unrelated medical condition, and at the time of this recording, I do not believe he has left the hospital in order to be formally charged with murder or booked into jail. Prior to the shooting, Billy Jack had been treated in a hospital for broken ribs caused by a fall, but decided to check out in order to be with his wife, who is reportedly suffering from dementia. This has all the makings of an incredibly sad story, but we still don't know any details about the exact circumstances of the shooting or what the potential motive might have been for murder. But in spite of these new developments, this still does not change my opinion that Billy Jack had nothing to do with the Boys on the Tracks murders, as he likely just fabricated the story for attention. Given that his schedule as a full-time WWF wrestler in 1987 would have required him to be on the road and wrestle around 300 times per year, I seriously doubt he would have had the time to become involved in a drug trafficking operation. As a side note, Billy Jack also once claimed involvement in the 1989 murder of Michael Franke, who was the director of Oregon's Department of Corrections, and along with the Boys on the Tracks, this case was also featured on Unsolved Mysteries. So it's pretty disturbing that after spending years placing himself at the center of all these infamous murders for unknown reasons, Billy Jack Haynes likely went on to commit a murder for real. So before we bring this episode to a close, I just wanted to provide one final update on the 1985 murder of Roger Dean, which took place in Littleton, Colorado, and was featured on Unsolved Mysteries and episode number 128 of The Trail Went Cold. As you might recall, a suspect named Michael Jefferson was charged with first-degree murder in April of 2021 after being linked to the crime via DNA evidence, but his trial is yet to take place, and no new information has been released to the media in the 3 years since Jefferson's arrest. I've only been following the case by checking the Colorado Judicial Branch's court docket website, where I've noticed that Jefferson's trial has been postponed multiple times. At the end of our last update episode, I revealed that his trial was scheduled to begin in February of this year, but guess what? It's been delayed again. At the time of this recording, the trial is now scheduled to start in late May and run into early June, so of course, I'll continue to keep you apprised of any further developments, and hopefully, I can finally share a conclusive resolution on our next update episode. Anyway, that brings an end to the Trail Went Cold's fifth special update episode, and if you would like to get in touch, feel free to send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 6 years, our Patreon page has released nearly 70 exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I actually released a bonus episode, which is our podcast's second edition of The Trail Revisited. And this time, I'm taking a fresh look at the infamous Circleville Letters case. I originally covered that story on the podcast 6 years ago, but I've since learned a ton of new information, and it has caused me to look at the case in a different light, so I decided to put together an entirely new episode. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover another memorable case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1989 disappearance of Patricia Meehan. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. Oh, and as an extra special bonus, I've also recently recorded an audio commentary over the recent Unsolved Mysteries Behind the Legacy documentary, and this one is available to all of our Patreon subscribers. I wanted to remind everyone that later this year, The Trail Went Cold has been booked to appear on Podcast Row at two separate CrimeCon events. The American CrimeCon, which is taking place at the Gaylord Opryland Hotel in Nashville from May the 31st until June the 2nd, and CrimeCon UK, which is taking place at 133 Houndsditch in London on September the 21st and 22nd. If you would like to purchase tickets, we have a specialized promo code to get a 10% discount at both events, so please visit crimecon.com or crimecon.co.uk and use the promo code COOL24. Once again, that's crimecon.com and crimecon.co.uk, and the promo code is COOL24 for 10% off tickets to both events. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Anyway, it bears repeating that it's just incredible that we've had this many cases featured on The Trail Went Cold, which have wound up being solved, so much so that there's been enough material to produce 5 separate update episodes, and I'm pretty sure this will not be our last. Anyway, I'll be back from vacation next week, so we'll return to our regular format, so join us next Wednesday as we present another brand new episode about an unsolved cold case on The Trail Went Cold.